Yes, it was, he said. But like the rest of our correct statements, it needs some explanation. What do you mean by common? There are lots of possibilities, and you're not going to get away without telling us which one you mean. We've been sitting around here patiently, assuming you were bound to say something about the production of children, what their practice will be in this regard, and how they will bring the children up once they are born, and this whole business you've suggested of women and children being in common. We think it's of great, indeed crucial importance for our state whether this is done in the right way or the wrong way. So when you started to deal with another regime before settling these questions in a satisfactory way, we made the decision you heard us making, not to let you go until you have given a full description of this topic, like the other topics. Count me in as well, said Glorkin, as a joint proposer of this motion. Take it as a unanimous decision, Socrates, Thrasymachus added. In that case, I said, I'd better go back and deal now with something I should perhaps have dealt with earlier, in its rightful place. Our intention, I take it, was to make the men in our hypothetical city into some kind of guardians of the herd. Yes. Shall we follow that up, then, by giving them a birth and upbringing consistent with this role? Shall we see whether or not that suits our purpose? What do you mean? I mean this. Do we think female watchdogs should do their share of watching in the same way as male watchdogs? Should they do their share of hunting and join in other activities? Or do we think that bearing and raising puppies makes them incapable of doing their share? Do we expect the females to stay at home indoors while the males do the work and have the whole responsibility for the flocks? We think they should join in everything, he said. We treat the females as weaker, though, and the males as stronger. Well, then, is it possible to employ one animal for the same tasks as another without giving it the same upbringing and training? No, it's not possible. So, if we're going to employ women for the same tasks as men, we must give them the same teaching. Yes, the education we gave men had a musical and poetic element, and a physical element. Yes. So women too should receive these two disciplines, plus military training, and they should be treated in the same way. It looks like it, he said, from what you've been saying. Much of what we are saying now is pretty unconventional. It may well seem absurd if our suggestions are really going to be put into practice. Indeed, it may. What do you find the most absurd thing about it? Isn't it, obviously, the idea of women taking exercise naked along with men in the wrestling schools? Not just young women, but older ones as well, like the old men you find in the gymnasiums. They're all wrinkled and by no means a pretty sight, but they still retain an enthusiasm for taking exercise. Yes, he replied, that would certainly look pretty absurd, at least the way things are at present. Well, now that we've brought the subject up, we mustn't be afraid of all the standard jokes we'd hear from humorists if we introduce changes of that sort in physical exercise, in musical and poetic education, and particularly in carrying arms and riding on horseback. You're right, he said. And since we have brought it up, we must get on to the difficult business of legislation, with a request to these comedians to be serious. We don't mind them not performing their own proper function. We can remind them that it is not so very long since the Greeks thought it immoral and absurd, as most foreigners still think it, for men to be seen naked. When first the Cretans and then the Spartans started exercising naked, all that became a legitimate target for the humorists of the day. Don't you agree? I do. I take it that once experience showed that you can do all these activities better, stripped, than wearing clothes, then too the perception of absurdity evaporated in the face of public recognition of what was best. It became clear that only a fool regards as laughable anything other than what is bad. Anyone who tries to be amusing by pointing at any spectacle other than the spectacle of folly and wickedness must quite seriously have set himself some standard of beauty other than that of the good. Exactly, he said. Well then, if we want a woman to become guardian material, we shall not have one education for making men guardians and another for making women guardians, shall we? Particularly when they have the same natural attributes to start with. No, we shall have the same education for both. Now, here's another point I'd like your opinion about. What is that? Whether you feel in your own mind that one man is better and another man is worse. Or do you think all men are the same? No, I certainly don't. Well then, in the city we founded, which do you think we shall find turn out the better men? The guardians who have received the education we described, or the shoemakers trained in the art of shoemaking? Well, that's a fatuous question, he said. I see. What about the rest of the citizens? Aren't the guardians better than all of them? Much better. What about the women? Won't the women guardians be the best of the women? Again, he said, much the best. Is there anything better for the city than for it to have its women and its men alike become as good as possible? No, there isn't. And will this be brought about by the availability of musical and physical education of the kind we described? Of course. So our arrangements are not only feasible, but also in the best interests of our city. Yes. They must strip, then, the women among our guardians. Virtue will be their cloak. They must play their part both in war and in being the guardians of the city in general. That and nothing else. And of those tasks, women should be given lighter ones than men, because their sex is weaker. Absolutely. Can we say, then, that in our provisions for the legal position of women, we have survived the first wave of criticism? In laying down that our male and female guardians should in all respects lead a common life, we have not been completely overwhelmed. That's certainly no small wave you have survived, he said. You won't think so when you see the next one. Go on, then. Let me see it. I believe that this law and the others which preceded it imply a further law. What law? That all these women shall be wives in common for all these men, that none of them shall live as individuals with any of the men, that children in turn shall belong to all of them, that no parent shall know its own child, no child its own parent. Yes, he said, when it comes to scepticism about the feasibility or utility of this proposal, that is a much larger wave than the first. I don't imagine there could be any disagreement about its utility. No one would deny that if it is possible, having wives in common and children in common is a major benefit. But on the question of its feasibility or otherwise, I suspect there would be a lot of disagreement. There'd be plenty of disagreement, he replied, on both counts. Be that as it may, for the moment, I'll assume our proposals are feasible. With your permission, I want to examine the way the rulers will organise these things when they do happen, and show that putting them into practice would be of the greatest possible benefit to the city and its guardians. I want you to help me make a thorough examination of those questions first, and leave the other questions until later, if that's all right with you. It's all right, he said. Begin your inquiry. Very well. It will be your job, just as you selected the men, so now to select the women as well, as similar as possible in nature, and allocate them to the men. Since houses and dining halls will be communal, and no one will possess any private property of this kind, the sexes will live in close proximity, and in this state of universal proximity, both in their physical education and in the rest of their upbringing, their natural instincts will inevitably, I think, lead them into having sex with one another. Or don't you regard that as inevitable? Well, it's not a mathematical inevitability, but it's a sexual inevitability, and for the majority of people that is probably a keener agent of persuasion and attraction. Much keener, I said. Now for the next point, Glaucon. In the city of the blessed, haphazard sexual intercourse is unholy. Like haphazard behaviour of any kind, the rulers will not allow it. No, because it is wrong. Clearly, the next step is for us to do everything we can to make marriages as sacred as possible. And it'll be the most useful marriages which are the sacred ones. Absolutely. What will make them the most useful? Tell me something, Glaucon. I've noticed that as well as hunting dogs, you have a fair number of purebred birds in your house. Isn't there one thing you surely must have noticed about their unions and production of children? What sort of thing? He asked. For a start, though they are all purebred, aren't some of them the best? Don't they prove themselves to be? Yes, they do. Do you, in that case, breed from all of them alike, or are you careful to breed as much as possible from the best? I breed from the best. What about age? Do you breed from the youngest or the oldest? Or do you breed as far as possible from those in their prime? From those in their prime. If the breeding is not handled like this, do you think your stock of birds and dogs will greatly deteriorate? Yes, I do. What about horses and other animals? I asked. Do you think they're in any way different? No, that would be absurd. Help! I exclaimed. We're going to need some extremely expert rulers, my dear friend, if the same applies to the human race as well. Well, it certainly does apply, but why do they have to be expert? I'll tell you. The probability is that our rulers will need to employ a good deal of falsehood and deception for the benefit of those they are ruling. On the principles we have agreed, the best men should have sex with the best women as often as possible, whereas for the worst men and the worst women, it should be the reverse. We should bring up the children of the best, but not the children of the worst, if the quality of our herd is to be as high as we can make it. And all this has to happen with no one, apart from the actual rulers, realizing it, if our herd of guardians is also to be as free as possible from dissension. Quite right. In that case, we must legislate for some festivals, at which we shall bring together the brides and their grooms. We must have sacrifices, and our poets must compose hymns appropriate to the unions which are taking place. We must have lotteries, and pretty ingenious ones, so that every time there is a marriage, the inferior type we want to exclude will blame chance, rather than the rulers. They'll have to be extremely ingenious, these lotteries of yours. Presumably, those among the young men who are outstanding in war or any other sphere are to be given various prizes and rewards, and in particular more generous permission to sleep with the women, so that as many of the children as possible can plausibly be fathered by young men of this sort. That's right. As for the children who will be born from time to time, they will be taken away by officials responsible for these things. These officials may be men or women, or men and women, since offices, I take it, are open to women and men alike. Yes. The children of good parents will be taken, I think, and transferred to the nursing pen, where there will be special nurses living separately in a special part of the city. The children of inferior parents, on the other hand, or any deformed specimen born to the other group, will be removed from sight into some secret and hidden place. As is right. Yes, he said, at any rate, if the breed of guardians is going to remain pure. Now, I said, let's continue in a systematic way with the task we set ourselves. We said children should be born to those in their prime. True. Well, do you agree that a reasonable span for a woman's prime is 20 years and for a man's 30? Which 20 and which 30? He asked. For a woman it means starting at 20 and going on bearing children for the city until 40. For a man, when his days as a sprinter are behind him, then he should father children for the city from that age until 55. Yes, he agreed, for both of them that is the prime of life, both physically and mentally. If someone older or younger than this takes part in producing children for the state, we shall call it an offence against the gods and against justice. And the same law applies if a man who is still entitled to father children gets access to a woman of the appropriate age without a ruler promoting the union. We shall say he is presenting the city with an illegitimate, unauthorized, and unholy child. And we shall be absolutely right, he said. Of course, when women and men pass the age for producing children, we shall declare them free, presumably, to have sex with anyone they like, apart from a daughter or a mother, or their daughter's daughters, or their mother's mothers. For a woman, anyone other than a son or father, or their son's sons or father's fathers. And all this only when we have first impressed upon them how careful they must be. If there is a pregnancy, then, ideally, the embryo should never see the light of day. If one does force its way into existence, the parents must deal with it on the understanding that they cannot bring up a child of this sort. That all seems quite reasonable, he said. But this business of fathers and daughters, and the relationships you were talking about just now, how will they tell their own from anyone else's? They won't. When a man takes part in a marriage, he will regard as his children all those born in the 10th month from the day of the festival. He will call the male children his sons, and the female children his daughters. They will call him father. Similarly, he will call the children's offspring his grandchildren, and they in turn will call his generation grandfathers and grandmothers. Those born during the period when their mothers and fathers were producing children, they will call their sisters and brothers. In this way, they can avoid one another, as we were suggesting just now. However, the law will allow unions between brothers and sisters, if that is how the lot falls out, and if the Pythian priestess gives her consent as well. Quite right. There you are, Glaucon. That's what it is for women and children to be in common among the guardians of your city. That's what it is like. The next thing we have to do is establish from what has been said that it is consistent with the rest of the Constitution, and that it is by far the best arrangement. Or should we go about things in some other way? No, that's the best way, undoubtedly. If we want to settle this, isn't a good starting point to ask ourselves what is the greatest good we can think of in the organisation of our city, the thing the lawgiver should be aiming at as he frames his laws, and what is the greatest evil? Then we can ask, do the proposals we have just described match the features of this good? Do they fail to match the features of this evil? Yes, that's the best possible starting point, he said. Well then, can we think of any greater evil for a city than what tears it apart and turns it into many cities instead of one? Or any greater good than what unites it and makes it one? No, we can't. Is it community of pleasure and pain which unites it, when as far as possible all the citizens are equally affected by joy or grief over any particular gain or loss? It certainly is. And is individual variation in these feelings divisive? Things happen to the city or to its inhabitants which make some people distraught and others delighted. Of course it's divisive. Is this because words like mine and not mine are not applied by everyone in the city to the same things? The same with somebody else's? It certainly is. Does that mean the best regulated city is the one in which the greatest number of people use this phrase mine or not mine in the same way, about the same thing? Much the best. When anything at all, good or bad, happens to one of its citizens, a city of this kind will be most inclined to say that what is affected is a part of itself. The whole city will rejoice together, or grieve together. Yes, it's bound to. A city with good laws, that is. This is the moment for us to return to our city, I said, and look for the characteristics our argument has led us to agree on. We want to know if this city possesses them to an outstanding degree, or if some other city does. Yes, we do need to go back and do that. Very well. Presumably, there are rulers and common people, aren't there, in other cities as well as in our city? There are. Do they all call one another citizens? Of course. But in other cities, what else does the common people call the rulers, apart from calling them citizens? In most cities, they call them their masters. In democratic cities, they just call them rulers. What about the common people in our city? What do they say their rulers are, apart from being citizens? Saviours and defenders, he said. And what do the rulers call the common people? Paymasters and providers. What do the rulers in other cities call their common people? Slaves. And what do the rulers call each other? Fellow rulers. What do ours call each other? Fellow guardians. Can you answer this, then? Would any of the rulers in the other cities find it possible to address one of his fellow rulers as a relative and another as unrelated? Yes, plenty of them would find that possible. Doesn't such a person think and speak of his relative as his and one who is unrelated as not his? Yes. What about your guardians? Could any of them think of one of his fellow guardians or address him as if he were unrelated? No, he said. Every time he meets any of them, he will assume he's meeting his brother or sister or father or mother or son or daughter or the child or parent of one of these. In that case, there will be greater agreement in this city than in any other about the terms we were referring to a moment ago. They will say of the success or failure of any individual, "This success is mine," or "This failure is mine." Very true, he said. And did we say that feeling pleasures and pains in common followed from this way of thinking and speaking? We did, and we were right. Then will our citizens, more than any others, hold one and the same thing, which they will call mine, in common. And because they feel the same about it, will they feel the greatest community of pain and pleasure? Very much the greatest. And the reason for this, over and above the general organisation of the city, is the business of women and children being in common among our guardians. Yes, that's the main reason, he said, far more important than anything else. And when it comes to making war, isn't it obvious how they will go about it? How? They will go on campaign together, bringing the most robust of the children with them on active service, so that, like the children of people in other skilled occupations, they can observe the occupation they will have to follow when they grow up. Besides observing, they should act as assistants and servants in everything to do with war, and be some help to their fathers and mothers. Haven't you noticed how people learn a skill? The children of potters, for example, spend a long time as assistants, watching, before they're allowed anywhere near a pot. A very long time. And are potters going to be more careful than our guardians when it comes to educating their own children, giving them the necessary experience and opportunity to observe? No, that would be ludicrous, he said. What is more, any living creature will fight better in the presence of its own young. That's true, but if they are defeated, and these things do happen in time of war, there's a very real danger, Socrates, that along with the guardians themselves, the children will be lost as well, and that this will make recovery impossible for the rest of the city. True, I said. But what is your view on that? Do you think, for instance, that the aim should be to avoid all possible risk? No. Well then, if they are going to take risks, shouldn't it be in situations where success will make them better people? Obviously. Do you think that for men who are going to be warlike, it makes very little difference, and is therefore not worth the risk, whether or not they can observe the art of war as children? No, it does make a difference in the way you suggest. What we want to bring about, then, is a way of making the children observers of war, while at the same time thinking of some clever means of ensuring their safety. That would be ideal, wouldn't it? Yes. Well then, I said, For one thing, their fathers will not be without experience. They will be as expert as human beings can be at judging which campaigns are dangerous and which are not. Fair enough. So they will take them on some campaigns, but think twice about others. Yes, that'll be the right approach. And to command them, their fathers will presumably not give them those who are least able, but those well qualified by age and experience to be guides and tutors. Yes, those will be the right people. Will this be enough? I asked. After all, events are unpredictable, as all sorts of people are constantly finding out. They certainly are. So, to meet unpredictable situations, we must give them wings, my friend, from their earliest childhood. Then they can take to flight if they have to. What do you mean? We must put them on horseback at the youngest possible age. Once we have taught them to ride, we can take them as observers, mounted on horses which are not spirited and warlike, but the swiftest and most obedient we can find. In this way they can get an excellent view of what will be their occupation, and still make their escape safely, if the need arises, by following guides who are older than they are. I think that's a good suggestion, he said. What about the actual fighting? I asked. Let's start with their behaviour towards each other. Anyone who out of cowardice leaves his place in the line, throws away his weapons or does anything of that sort, should be reduced to the rank of skilled worker or farmer. Shouldn't he? He certainly should. Anyone who falls alive into the hands of the enemy can be handed over as a gift to those who capture him. They can do what they like with their catch. By all means. As for someone who wins a prize for valour and distinguishes himself, don't you think that in the first place he should be crowned there in the field by the adolescents and children, every one of them in turn, who are on campaign with him? I do. How about being shaken by the hand? Yes, that too. You won't agree with my next suggestion, I don't suppose. What is it? That he should kiss and be kissed by each of them. That above all, and I propose an amendment to this law. For the duration of the campaign, no one he wants to kiss shall be allowed to refuse. That should make anyone who is in fact in love with someone else, whether that someone is male or female, all the more determined to win a prize. Excellent, I said. After all, it has already been decided that the good man is to get more marriages than other people, and that the good should be selected more frequently than the rest, so that as many children as possible may be born to parents of this kind. Yes, we did decide that. Very well. Then we come to those killed on active service. If anyone dies after covering himself with glory, shall we not say first of all that he is a member of the golden class? We certainly shall. And shall we inquire of Apollo how we ought to bury these superhuman, these divine people, and what mark of distinction we should give them? And shall we then bury them in the way he recommends? We certainly shall. For the rest of time shall we look after their graves as those of superhumans and bow down before them? Shall we follow this same observance on the death of anyone who is judged to have been outstandingly good in his life, whether he dies from old age or any other cause? Yes, he said, that will be the right thing to do. Now, what about the enemy? How will our soldiers treat them? What do you mean? Take enslavement for a start. Do you think it is right for Greeks to enslave Greek cities? Or should they rather do everything they can to stop any other city doing so? Should they encourage other cities always to spare the Greek race and so protect themselves against enslavement by the barbarians? Yes, sparing them is far and away the best policy. Is the best thing, then, for them to avoid owning Greek slaves themselves and also to advise other Greeks not to own them? It certainly is, he said. That way they are likely to turn their attention more towards the barbarians and leave one another alone. How about plundering the dead, I asked, after a victory? Apart from their weapons, that is that the right thing to do? Doesn't it give cowards an excuse not to go after those who are offering resistance, as if they were performing some useful task in grubbing round the body on their hands and knees? Haven't armies often been lost as a result of this kind of looting? Yes, very often. Besides, doesn't plundering corpses strike you as demeaning and mercenary? Isn't it petty and womanish to go on regarding the body of the dead person as hostile, once the enemy has flown, leaving behind the instrument he was fighting with? Can you see any difference at all between a person behaving like this and dogs which get angry with the stones they are hit by, but show no interest in the person throwing them? No, he said, no difference at all. Should we then put a stop to plundering corpses, and refusing to allow an enemy to take up the dead for burial? We most certainly should. They won't, I imagine, take their weapons to their temples to present as offerings, particularly not the weapons of Greeks, if they are at all interested in maintaining good relations with the rest of Greece. They are more likely to be afraid there may be some pollution in bringing offerings of this kind to a temple from their fellow Greeks, unless, of course, God tells them something different. Quite right. And because they are Greeks, they will not lay waste to Greece, or burn houses, or accept that all the inhabitants of a city, men, women, and children alike, are their enemies. They will regard their enemies at any particular time as few, the ones responsible for the dispute. For all these reasons, they will refuse to lay waste the land or destroy the houses of people whom they mostly regard as their friends. They will pursue their dispute only up to the point where those responsible are compelled by those who are not responsible, and who are suffering as a result, to make amends. For my part, he said, I agree that this is how our citizens should treat their enemies. As for the barbarians, they should treat them in the way Greeks at the moment treat one another. Should we then lay down another law for our guardians, forbidding them to devastate land or burn houses? Yes, we should. And let us by all means lay it down that we're satisfied both with these arrangements and with our earlier ones. The fact is, Socrates, if you're allowed to go on talking about this kind of thing, I don't think you'll ever come back to the question you originally postponed in order to go into all these details. You needn't go on discussing the arrangements. Instead, can we concentrate on giving ourselves a convincing answer to the questions? Are they possible and how are they possible? We can forget about the rest. That's a very direct assault, I said, on my way of explaining things. You don't have a great deal of sympathy with my misgivings. What you perhaps don't realise, after I have narrowly escaped the first two waves of criticism, is that you are now exposing me to a third, the largest and most threatening of the three. But you will have a lot of sympathy when you see it and hear it. You will see why I hesitated, why I was afraid to put forward such an unlikely-sounding answer for examination. The more excuses you make, the less chance there is that we shall let you off telling us how these political arrangements are possible. Stop playing for time and tell us. Well, the first thing to remember, I said, is that we have reached this point in the course of an inquiry into the nature of justice and injustice. Fair enough. What follows from that? Only this. If we do discover what sort of thing justice is, are we then going to decide that the just man must be in no way different from justice itself, but in every way like justice? Or will we be content if he comes as close to it as possible and has a larger measure of it than anyone else? We shall be content with that, he said. So, when we asked what sort of thing justice was by itself and looked for the perfectly just man if he existed and asked what he would be like if he did exist, what we were looking for was a model. The same with injustice and the unjust man. We wanted to look at the perfectly just and unjust man, see how we thought they were placed in respect of happiness and its opposite, and be compelled to agree, for ourselves as well, that whoever came closest to those examples would have a share of happiness which came closest to theirs. It wasn't our aim to demonstrate that these things were possible. True enough. Suppose a painter paints a picture which is a model of the outstandingly beautiful man. Suppose he renders every detail of his painting perfectly, but is unable to show that it is possible for such a man to exist. Do you think that makes him any the worse a painter? Good heavens, no. Then what about us? Aren't we in the same position? Can't we claim to have been constructing a theoretical model of a good city? We certainly can. And is it possible for anything to be put into practice exactly as it is described? Or is it natural for practice to have less hold on truth than theory has? I don't care what some people may think. What about you? Do you agree or not? I agree, he said. Then don't keep trying to compel me to demonstrate that the sort of thing we have described in a theoretical way can also be fully realized in practice. If we turn out to be capable of finding how a city can be run in a way pretty close to what we have described, then you can say that we have discovered how what you are asking for can be put into practice. Or won't you be satisfied with that? I know I would. So would I. In that case, what we have to do is try to discover and point out what the failings are in cities nowadays which stop them being run in this way, and what is the minimum change which could help a city arrive at political arrangements of this kind. Ideally, a single change. Failing that, two, and failing that, as few as possible in number and as small as possible in impact. Absolutely, he said. All right, then. There is one change which I think would allow us to show that things could be different. It is not a small change, or an easy one, but it is possible. What is it? We've been using the analogy of waves. Well, now I'm coming to the largest wave, but I'll make my suggestion anyway, even if it is literally the laughter of the waves which is going to engulf me in ridicule and humiliation. Listen carefully to what I'm about to say. Tell me. There is no end to suffering, Glaucon, for our cities, and none, I suspect, for the human race, unless either philosophers become kings in our cities, or the people who are now called kings and rulers become, in the truest and most complete sense of the word, philosophers. Unless there is this amalgamation of political power and philosophy, with all those people whose inclination is to pursue one or other exclusively being forcibly prevented from doing so. Otherwise, there is not the remotest chance of the political arrangements we have described coming about, to the extent that they can, or seeing the light of day. This is the claim which I was so hesitant about putting forward, because I could see what an extremely startling claim it would be. It is hard for people to see that this is the only route to happiness for a city in its arrangements for the private or public life of its inhabitants. My own personal view is that there is no reason to regard either or both of these events as impossible. If they were impossible, we would quite rightly be a laughingstock, since our proposals would just be wishful thinking. Isn't that so? It is. Now, will anyone challenge our contention that it is possible for the sons of kings and rulers actually to be born with philosophical natures? No, he said. No one in the world would challenge that. And if they are born with philosophical natures, can anyone claim they are certain to be corrupted? Even we admit that it is difficult for them to survive. But is anyone going to contend that in the whole of time, out of all those who are born, not one is ever going to survive? How could they? But it only needs there to be one, surely, with a city which is obedient to him, to bring about all the things which are now regarded as impossible. Yes, one is enough, he said. After all, If a ruler establishes the laws and way of life we have described, it is presumably not impossible that the citizens will be prepared to follow them. Not in the least impossible. Is it astonishing or impossible that the arrangements which seem a good idea to us should seem a good idea to other people as well? Well, I don't think so. That they are the best arrangements, assuming they are possible, has been satisfactorily shown by our earlier discussion, I think. Yes, it has. So the position we seem to have reached on law-giving is this. Our arrangements are the best, if only they could be put into effect. And while it is difficult for them to be put into effect, it is not impossible. Yes, he said, that is the position we've reached. Well then, since that topic has struggled to a conclusion, we'd better go on to deal with the ones which remain. These saviours of our city, what will prepare them for their task? What course of study and way of life? And when should each age group tackle each subject? Yes, we'd better deal with that. You'll realise there probably won't be very many of them. The elements of the nature we have described and which we say they must possess are seldom likely to be combined in the same individual. In most people, this kind of nature is fragmented. How do you mean? Well, you're aware that those who have a love of learning, a good memory, intelligence, quickness of wit, and everything which follows from those qualities, and who at the same time are developing energy and greatness of spirit, are unlikely to become the kind of people who are naturally inclined to lead an orderly, sober, and steadfast life. Quickness of wit carries people all over the place, and steadfastness goes out of the window. True, he said. Steadfast characters, by contrast, slow to change, the sort of people you can much more depend on, who in time of war are immovable in the face of danger, are likewise steadfast and slow to change even when it comes to learning. They are immovable and unteachable as if they'd been drugged. They are full of sleep and yawns whenever they have to work hard at something of this sort. Yes, that's true. But we said our guardians must be liberally endowed with both sets of qualities. Otherwise they are not to be given the fullest education, respect or power. Quite right, too. In which case, don't you think the philosophical character will be a rare one? Of course it will. It must be tested in the hardships, fears and pleasures we were talking about a little earlier. What's more, we can now add something we omitted then, which is that we must exercise it in many branches of study to see if it will be capable of enduring the most demanding ones, or if it's an intellectual coward, the way some people are physical cowards. Yes, he said, it's a good idea to find that out. But what are these most demanding studies of yours? You may remember us distinguishing three qualities of the soul with a view to drawing conclusions about justice. Self-discipline, courage and wisdom, and what each of these things was. If I didn't remember that, I would deserve to miss the rest of this discussion. Can you remember what came just before that? No. What? What we said, I believe, was that we could either get the best possible view of them, but only after a long detour, at the end of which they would be clearly revealed, or we could give an explanation on a level with the discussion so far. You said that was good enough, and as a result, what was said then fell short of complete accuracy, in my opinion, though whether it was good enough for your purposes is for you to say. As far as I'm concerned, he said, you gave us good measure, and the same goes for the others, I think. In matters like these, my friend, a measure which in any way at all falls short of what really is no measure at all. What is incomplete can never be the measure of anything, though for some people there are times when they are satisfied with that and feel they don't have to look any further. Yes, there are plenty of people who feel like that. It's laziness. Well, I said, it's not a feeling we want a guardian of our city and laws to have. Fair enough. In which case, my friend, our guardian must go round by the longer road. He must work as hard at studying as he does at physical training. Otherwise, as we've just been saying, he will never see the most important and appropriate subject of study through to the end. I thought we'd dealt with the most important subject. Is there some subject even more important than justice and the things we've been describing? Yes, I said. There is something more important. Also, with these virtues themselves, we shouldn't be looking at a mere outline of them the way we are now. What we want is their realization in every detail. We must not neglect that. Isn't it absurd to make every effort and do everything we can to reach the greatest possible precision and clarity over things of little significance, and then decide that the most important things deserve less than total precision? Utterly absurd. But this thing you call most important, and its subject matter, whatever you say that is, do you imagine anyone will let you go without asking you what it is? Of course I don't. Why don't you ask me? You've heard the answer often enough before, and now you've either forgotten it, or else this is another plan to make my life difficult by not letting me get away with anything. It must be the second reason, I think. You've often heard me say that the most important branch of study is the form or character of the good, that which just things and anything else must make use of if they are to be useful and beneficial. You must know that's what I'm going to say now, and you must also know that it's not something we can have adequate knowledge of. But if we don't know it, then however much we know about everything else, without that, as you are well aware, it'll be no more good to us than to possess something without the good. Do you think it's any use to us to own all there is and yet not own anything good? Or to be wise in everything but the good, but have no wisdom about what is beautiful and good? Good heavens, no, I certainly don't. Another thing you're well aware of is that while most people think the good is pleasure, those with more sophistication think it is knowledge. Of course. And further, my friend, that those who hold this view are unable to show what knowledge it is. They are compelled, in the end, to say that it is knowledge of the good. A pretty absurd definition, he said. How can it fail to be absurd? They criticise us for not knowing what the good is, and then immediately assume we do know what it is. They say the good is knowledge of the good, as if we're bound to understand what they're talking about, as soon as they so much as utter the word good. Absolutely true. What about those who define the good as pleasure? Are they any less wide of the mark than the others? Aren't they, in their turn, compelled to admit that there are bad pleasures? Very much so. Hence, I imagine, they find themselves admitting that the same things are good and bad. Don't they? Of course. Is it clear, then, that it is a subject on which there are many serious disagreements? Yes, it is. And isn't something else clear? With justice or beauty, lots of people might settle for the appearance of them. Even if things aren't really just or beautiful, they might choose to do, possess, or think them anyway. When it comes to things which are good, on the other hand, no one has ever yet been satisfied with the appearance. They want things that really are good. They all treat the appearance of it with contempt. Yes, that's very clear too, he said. This is what every soul follows. All its actions are directed at this. It has a sort of divine intuition that the good is something, but it is in doubt, unable to get a firm grasp on what it is, or find any firm belief of the kind it has about other things. As a result, it loses whatever benefit it might have got from those other things. Are we to accept that even those best people in the city, to whom we are planning to entrust everything, must remain in the dark about something of this nature and importance? Certainly not. But if it's not known, I said, in what way just and beautiful things are good. And if in particular a guardian does not know this, what kind of guardian will justice and beauty have got for themselves then? One who is not much of an asset to them, in my opinion. And I have an intuition that no one will have a satisfactory knowledge of justice and beauty without knowing this first. A sound enough intuition. Well then, will we get the best arrangements for our society if the guardian supervising it is the kind of person who does know these things? We're bound to. In that case, let me remind you about things which were said earlier in the discussion, and which have been said on many occasions in the past. What things might they be? We say there are many beautiful things and many good things, and the same with everything else. That is how we classify them in speaking of them. Yes, we do say that. We also say there is a beautiful itself and a good itself, and the same with all the things we then said were many. Applying the procedure in reverse, we relate them to a single form or character of each, since we believe it is single, and call it what each is. That is so. The many things, we say, can be seen but not thought, whereas the forms or characters of things can be thought but not seen. Exactly. Very well. Which of our faculties do we use to see the things we see? Our sight, he said, and our hearing for the things we hear, and our other senses for everything we perceive? Of course. Have you ever noticed, I asked, how much more extravagantly the creator of the senses has made the power of seeing and being seen than the other senses? No, I haven't. Look at it this way. For hearing to hear, and sound to be heard, do they need some other class of thing as well? Without this third thing, will hearing fail to hear and sound fail to be heard? No, they don't need any other class of thing, he said. I suspect that many other faculties, I won't say all of them, have no need for any further thing of this sort. Can you think of any? No, I can't. How about the faculty of sight and the thing which is seen? Has it ever struck you that those do need something of this sort? How do you mean? If there is sight in the eyes, and its possessor is trying to make use of it, you surely realise that even in the presence of colour, sight will see nothing, and the colours will remain unseen unless one further thing joins them, a third sort of thing which exists for precisely this purpose. What thing do you mean? The thing you call light. True, he said. In that case, because it involves a third thing of this important character, the link between the faculty of sight and the ability to be seen is something more valuable than the links between the other faculties and their objects. Unless, of course, light has no value. Well, it certainly does have a value. Which of the heavenly gods, then, do you take to be the agent responsible for this? Whose is the light which best enables our faculty of sight to see, and the things which are seen to be seen? The one you or anyone else would take to be responsible, he said, the one you're asking about is obviously the sun. Now, do you agree with me about the natural relationship of sight to this god? What are you saying about it? Sight is not the sun, neither sight itself, nor the place in which it occurs and which we call the eye. No, it isn't. But of all the organs of perception, I would say the eye is the most sun-like, much the most. So the power which it has, the ability to see, it receives from the sun as a kind of grant from an overflowing treasury. Exactly. So, too, the sun is not sight, but it is the cause of sight, and it can be seen by sight. That is so, he said. This is what you must take me to mean by the child of the good, which the good produces as its own analogue. In the world of thought, the good stands in just the same relation to thinking and the things which can be thought as the sun in the world of sight stands to seeing and the things which can be seen. What do you mean, he said. Please explain that a bit further. You know that when the eyes stop being directed at objects whose colours are in daylight and turn to those whose colours are lit by the lights of the night, they are dimmed and become virtually blind, as if there were no clear sight in them. They certainly do. Whereas, when they are directed at things whose colours have the light of the sun shining on them, they see distinctly. The same eyes now manifestly do have sight in them. Of course. You can look at the soul in the same way. When it focuses where truth and that which is shine forth, then it understands and knows what it sees, and does appear to possess intelligence. But when it focuses on what is mingled with darkness, on what comes into being and is destroyed, then it resorts to opinion and is dimmed, as if its opinions swing first one way and then another. Now, by contrast, it resembles something with no understanding. None at all. You can say that this thing which gives the things which are known their truth, and from which the knower draws his ability to know, is the form or character of the good. Because it is the cause of knowledge and truth, think of it by all means as something known, but you will be right to regard it as different from and still more beautiful than knowledge and truth, beautiful though both of these are. Just as in our example it is correct to think of light and vision as sun-like, but incorrect to think that they are the sun, in the same way here it is correct to think of knowledge and truth as good-like, but incorrect to think that either of them is the good. The good is something to be prized even more highly. "It's an incredible beauty you're talking about," he said. "If it is the cause of knowledge and truth, but itself surpasses them in beauty. And you, of all people, presumably, are not going to say that it is pleasure." "Be silent," I said. "Don't even mention the word no. Take a closer look at our comparison." "How do you want me to look at it?" "The sun gives to what is seen," I think you would say, "not only its ability to be seen, but also birth, growth, and sustenance, though it is not itself birth or generation." "Of course it isn't. For the things which are known say not only that their being known comes from the good, but also that they get their existence and their being from it as well, though the good is not being, but something far surpassing being in rank and power." "Ye gods!" Glaucon exclaimed, making us all laugh. "What a miraculous transcendence!" "Don't blame me," I said. "You were the one who compelled me to tell you what I thought about the subject." "I was. And whatever you do, don't stop now. If nothing else, at least go through your comparison with the sun to make sure you haven't left anything out." "I've left all sorts of things out," I said. "Well, don't. Don't omit even the smallest detail." "I'm sure I shall omit something. Quite a lot, probably. All the same, as far as is possible on an occasion like this, I won't leave anything out on purpose." "No, don't," he said. "Very well. You must be aware, as we said, that there are these two things. One of them is ruler of the category and realm of what can be understood. The other is ruler of what can be seen. Of the heavenly seen, I could say, only I don't want you to think I'm playing with words. Anyway, be that as it may, you accept that there are these two forms of things, the seen and the understood." "Yes, I do." "Imagine taking a line which has been divided into two unequal sections, and dividing each section, the one representing the category of the seen, and the one representing the category of the understood, again in the same proportion. The clearness or obscurity of the sections of the line relative to one another you will find to be as follows. In the category of the seen, the first section is images, by which I mean in the first place shadows, and in the second place reflections in water, or any dense, smooth, shiny surface. Everything of that sort, if you see what I mean." "Yes, I do." "The second section you must regard as what the first section is an image of. The animals we see every day, the entire plant world, and the whole class of human artifacts." "Very well, I so regard it. Now, looking at our division in terms of truth and its opposite, would you be prepared to say that the distinction between the likeness and the thing it is a likeness of is equivalent to the distinction between the object of opinion and the object of knowledge?" "Yes, I would," he said, "most emphatically." "Ask yourself next how the section which represents the understood should be divided. How should it be? Like this. In the first part, the soul treats as images the things which in the other section of the line were originals. It is compelled to work from assumptions, proceeding to an end point, rather than back to an origin or first principle. In the second part, by contrast,